Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. I am delighted to be sharing my interview with Ben Hunt Davis, MBE, which stands for Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. So Ben is an Olympic gold medalist who won the rowing in the Sydney 2000 Olympics. He is also an author and a business coach. His book, Will It Make the Boat Go Faster, is a brilliant read for anyone wanting to improve their business or their life. Ben has learned some huge lessons over the years, and we really dig deep and learn about how he found success in dealing with his problems. It was truly an honour to have him on the show and my absolute pleasure to interview him in the Google Podcasting Studios. So without further ado, I bring to you a truly upstanding gentleman, Ben Hunt Davis. Hello and good morning and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Ben Hunt Davis in the studio, who is Olympic gold medal winner and now runs Will It Make the Boat Go Faster, a coaching success company for businesses mainly.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks a lot for inviting me along, Sam.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for being here. Eventually, we've had a few upsets. Oh yeah, should mention that we are in the Google Podcasting Studio. So thanks, Google. I quite like getting to know people's sort of story. So I try and get them to boil down their life into about 3 or 4 minutes just at the start, just to make you slightly uncomfortable and kind of give me like a canvas of interesting places to kind of ask you about questions.
So my life in 3 or 4 minutes, I don't think it'll take that long. So I was brought up mostly in the Far East. My dad was in the army in the Brigade of Gurkhas. So I lived in Nepal, Brunei, Hong Kong while growing up. Was lucky enough to go to a secondary school in the UK that rowed. Started rowing because I couldn't do anything else. Kept rowing. I still wasn't very good at that. I ended up going to 3 Olympics and 6 World Championships. Since then, I've supported Team GB as part of the leadership team, the Beijing, London and Rio Olympics. Wrote a book called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? Now have a business called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? And that's about 3 minutes.
That was more like 1 minute. That's right. That was super fast.
I said it wouldn't take long.
Yeah, but that's cool because it gives us more time to go into these things because of there seems like a lot of stories behind it. So did you spend a lot of time in Nepal and Brunei when you were there? Or was it more like...
Yeah, so Brunei, I was kind of really young and I lived there twice actually for a year and a half and then 2 years or something. Hong Kong had 4 different times living there at different ages, and Nepal lived there for 2.5 years. So, and I was at boarding school at the time. So It was then school in England and school holidays in Nepal. And it was incredible. It was absolutely amazing. It was between 1985 and 87, 88. In that time, my parents managed to make 2 phone calls out of the country in 2.5 years because you just... Wow. Couldn't do it from where we were. Kathmandu was really, it was incredible. And every single holiday, we went trekking around the hills, the foothills, which is where the Gurkhas come from.
Yeah.
And both my parents were fluent in Nepalese. So every single village you went to, you'd have a conversation with some old soldier. Go, oh, Saab, I remember serving with you. And we'd get invited to a house for a cup of tea. And we got to see Nepal from a really incredible angle. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Wow. That sounds really cool.
It was in all the different places, we were always with Gurkhas. And so... getting to know them was incredible. I mean, they're amazing people.
Yeah. So do you think that sort of set you up from the start to be in a bit of a mindset of trying to be the best and things? Because they're pretty focused on like super hard training and
they're pretty, ordinary. I mean, they're incredibly tough, yeah. Resilient, driven people. And for them, joining the British Army then was the ultimate goal for everyone. And you go along to hill selection where you get kind of old soldiers from a number of different villages bringing along the young men of the village, and they've got to do some exams, they've got to do some running and some pull-ups and kind of all sorts of gym tests. And it's just a way out of poverty. It's a way to see the world. And they look at the old soldiers in the village who are role models, and they know the stories about what Gurkhas have done over the years, how many Victoria Crosses they've won, you know, bravest of the brave, most generous of the generous. They're amazing. And it was incredible growing up with them around the whole time.
Yeah, that sounds really inspiring. Did you have any other role models on the topic that have sort of shaped what you did with your career?
My dad, I think, to a large degree. I mean, he talked about a few things about, you know, doing our better best. And if at first you don't succeed, try again. And, you know, there were kind of various different sayings. And he was, you know, really successful at what he did. And he expected us to try hard at stuff and not give up because things got a bit tough. So I think I took quite a lot from him, really. I didn't have sporting role models. I mean, I'd watched the Olympics and watched Seb Coe and Daley Thompson. I thought they were amazing. They were completely different from me, and there was no point in comparing me to any of them. So I didn't really have any sporting role models.
With the Gurkhas, how they're sort of, it's only like one step away of like, okay, if I work hard, I'll be like this guy. Whereas in, it's not that obvious if you're sort of thinking like, oh, if you look at Seb Coe, he's amazing. Okay, I'll just like train hard and I can be like an Olympian.
And then I'll never, ever, ever be like them. Whereas, you know, the Gurkhas, you just see them, they have a certain attitude and they work hard. And that was kind of maybe easier to relate to.
Yeah, definitely. So you said your parents only managed like the odd phone call. So how did you keep in touch when you were at school? Did you write mail?
Letters, yeah. So I got letters from my mum every single week for 10 years at boarding school. And kind of when I was younger at boarding school, I had to send a letter home every week, which was obviously read by the teacher. So you could really write exactly what you wanted. Or not. And then, you see them on holidays. I mean, it's kind of nuts now that you can call anyone anywhere. Email is instant. Then, you had a problem and you wrote a letter, and from Nepal, you got a reply maybe 3 weeks later.
Wow. So, yeah, it must have been quite a weird conversation, like, of if you're sending every 1 week, but like you're getting like the 3 weeks ago letter. And it's kind of funny when you like in WhatsApp now, you'll have like two conversations going on at once where you'll just say one thing and the next thing, but then they'll reply to the first thing and then they'll be also talking about the second thing.
But imagine that over 3 weeks.
Instead, that's just like crazy.
And that used to be normal.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It's weird. It's really weird.
I've been writing a lot more letters whilst I've been traveling. It's really nice. It's quite like artistic almost, in the same way that you might like paint like a piece of art. So I think it's sort of something that I can kind of sit down for like half an hour, actually sort of think about like creating with my words.
So I think letters can be really special like that. With a letter, you're going to probably think it through properly and you're going to be thoughtful about what you do, which I think gives it more meaning. So I mean, that's not how I thought about them when I was growing up, but getting the letter home, you know, from home each week was a big thing.
Yeah. So let's get back to the actual topic at hand, which is your life and Olympics and things, which I think is the next on the list. So how did you go from school to becoming like a potential Olympic athlete? Did you get like drafted whilst you were doing your rowing?
So the way rowing selection works is there are certain dates where there are trials and anyone can turn up for trials. And if you're fast enough, you get through to the next set. And if you do well enough there, you get through to the next set and you keep going until you get selected. So at school, I rowed simply because I couldn't catch a cricket ball or hit one. So I rowed because I just hated ball sports because I was rubbish. The first year rowing, I didn't make the school boat. The second year, I made the school boat for my age group when I was 15 because there were only 8 of us in the year, so that was kind of lucky. The next year, I started doing well and I loved it, absolutely loved it. At school, I rowed simply because I couldn't catch a cricket ball or hit one. So I rowed because I just hated ball sports because I was rubbish. And so when I was kind of lower sixth, I went off to the first set of national team trials, did well and kept going. And actually that year, I missed out on the team going to the Junior World Championships by one place and went to a kind of European B team event. At school, I rowed simply because I couldn't catch a cricket ball or hit one. So I rowed because I just hated ball sports because I was rubbish. And I was gutted I'd missed out on going to the World Champs. So the next year, my sole goal was to be a Junior World Champion. I didn't really care about anything else. I just wanted to be a Junior World Champion. And the whole year, I trained my arse off to be a Junior World Champion. And I came fourth in the final and was absolutely gutted. So I couldn't do juniors anymore. So as I was pissed off and dissatisfied, the next thing was the under 23s. So I trained my ass off to go to the under 23s and we lost there and I was gutted. And the next year was, well, either go to the under 23s or possibly get into the kind of proper national team. And as it was, I did well enough in trials and ended up going to the Olympics and I came last in the final. I was gutted. And the next year I went to the World Championships and I didn't fifth in the final, I think it was gutted. The next year I didn't make the final and was gutted. And I just kept being really pissed off, so I had to keep going.
Did you have a job? Was that then developed, or were you like spending like your whole day training?
So after school, I went to Oxford Brookes Poly, as it was in those days, and I rowed for them for a bit, but it wasn't set up the way it was now. I rode for another 6 months and rode there for the next, for the second half of the year. And so supposedly I was studying. I didn't really do much studying.
Where's your degree?
I started civil engineering.
I started that as well. Oh.
How far did you get?
I did a month adjacent biology. Right. They're talking so much about concrete and I'd had a gap year and forgotten how to do like differential equations. Right. And I was just like, yeah, maybe biology is really fun and stuff.
I started a different degree. I started town planning because I'd failed my first year at civil engineering and people told me town planning was easy. And about 6 weeks in, they wanted me to hand some work in, which clearly I hadn't done. And at that point, the head coach was saying, right, you've got a chance to get into the Olympics. Do you want to study or do you want to row? So that was perfect get-out clause. And I left university and just rowed full-time for a number of years. And I did a whole lot of work on the side. I worked in a bingo hall. I coached rowing. I did various bits of labouring, whatever I could to pay the bills so I could train full-time.
What was it like back then? Because I know now if you get, there's like different grades of what status you are, you get like a different wage to be like, just to train to be an Olympian kind of thing. Did you kind of have that?
No. So when we started, there was nothing. So when I went to the Barcelona Olympics, we didn't have to pay to go to the Olympics, but for every single regatta, for a world and a World Cup championships, it cost 800 quid to go to. And so the club paid half of that and also gave me some petrol money so I could get to the club. And so by the end of the year, you're in debt. And then in, I think it was 93, Littlewood Pool started up the Foundation of Sport and Art that I think gave me 100 quid a week. And so 5 grand a year. I mean, that pays for your regattas and training camps and that's it. So then you're running in debt after that. So I mean, I kind of worked whatever I could. In those days, most people rode for a kind of limited amount of time because you've got to get on with life and there's no money in it. In 97, John Major started the National Lottery with the aim that a lot of the money went to sport. And then it changed. It was tough.
What was like your training regime then?
Generally, we did kind of a 2.5 day cycle. So days 1 and 2 would be full day. So you do 3, possibly 4 sessions. Day 3 would be a half day where you do probably 2, sometimes 3 sessions. And you do 2.5 day cycle. Training 7 days a week. We got 3 weeks off after a World Championships. And then maybe another 5 or 6 days off in the year. So we were doing between 15 and 21 training sessions a week.
Wow. And how long is a training session?
Varied from 2 hours to an hour, probably.
Basically your whole day.
Yeah.
And then eating in between and stuff. How much would you eat a day?
So I eat about 7,000 calories a day. First breakfast, 8 Weetabix.
Yeah.
Second breakfast, whole load of toast with maybe some eggs or something. Lunch, maybe 0.5 kilo bag of pasta with some sauce or some baked potatoes or rye, you know, something equivalent. Tea would be another 0.5 loaf of bread or something. And then dinner would be another 0.5 kilo bag of pasta or equivalent with some veg and, you know, that's stuff.
Crazy. How much time did you spend cooking?
Not that much time cooking, but a lot of time eating. I eat really slowly. So lunch and dinner would both take me an hour to eat a 500 grams of pasta. Yeah.
Can eat quite quickly if I choose to. Prefer not to. It's not very fun.
Yeah, but I'm slow.
Yeah, I won the Bristol Burrito Eating Championship back in the day.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks. It's not quite an Olympic medal, but you know, it's something. We've all got our own claims to fame. But yeah, I did a cycle the length of Britain, which was about 7,000 calories a day.
Right.
And yeah, it was a pretty interesting sort of experience realizing how much you needed to eat, but I never like lived with it for more than like a few weeks. But like, how did you adjust to when you weren't training? So when you say you had like the 3 weeks off, did you sort of change your diet much?
No, I'm sure I ate a bit less, but I'm naturally a scrawny git, so I'm lucky. Yeah. We're struggling to maintain weight while training.
Mm.
So during the 3 weeks off, I mean, it depends what I was doing, but I mean, I wouldn't be rigid about having 5 meals a day and eating 7,000 calories, but I think I still had a pretty healthy appetite.
Wow. That's crazy. And I guess you didn't drink much because it's not like it was such a, I know back then, like these days, everyone's like super, super strict on things. But did you know exactly what you were getting with your specific macros and like?
So it wasn't that scientific. We worked with a dietitian who, you know, looked at what we were eating, sending in a bit more of this, a bit less of that. But it's totally different from what it's like now. In terms of drinking, Jürgen's view was a beer is fine. 5 beers is not fine and spirits are not fine. Frankly, I didn't drink very much. I mean, there were nights where I went out and, you know, went on a bender, but most evenings I just didn't drink anything. I just saved it on the odd occasion. But, you know, there weren't many of those nights because what I really wanted to do was train hard the next day. That's just what I wanted to do. So when I left school, I lost contact with most of my mates because they wanted to get as pissed as they could, as often as they could. And I wanted to train. And the two things, frankly, are just not that compatible.
One of my favorite things to do is if I am hungover is to go and like train until like my brain feels vaguely normal again.
It's the best hangover cure.
But it's not the same because you still spend the rest of the day being tired because you didn't sleep very well and you're a bit like out of it. I kind of definitely relate to I kind of stopped drinking pretty much just because I kind of wanted to have access to my brain the next day and do useful stuff. But yeah, so you would say you lost like a lot of your friends then doing that. Did you actively notice that and feel bad, but sort of carried on? Or was it just like, oh, it just happened to happen? And it didn't feel like a sacrifice as such. It was more just like, oh, that's just what you were doing.
I'm not sure how many sacrifices I made because I just did what I wanted to do. And, you know, people quite often ask, you know, oh, what did you give up or how many sacrifices? And I'm just not sure I made many because I think a sacrifice is where you give up doing what you want to do something else. And actually what I wanted to do was train hard. So there were lots of weddings I didn't go to. There were loads of things I didn't do. But it was always my choice. No one was making me do this. No one was paying me to be there. If I didn't turn up, I was letting the other guys down. But no one had any sway over me at all. If I didn't turn up, it meant I wasn't going to get selected and all the rest of it. But it was totally my choice. And so, yeah, leaving school, it was my choice whether what I did in an evening before I went training the next day. And generally, my head was on training the next day rather than, you know, people would ring up and go, oh, you know, we're going out here. Do you want to come? And my answer was generally no, because I was just doing what I wanted to do and I had a different set of mates.
Yes. A really good explanation because I guess that's kind of how I thought about some of these things. So it's not like I felt like I was sacrificing things at the time. It's more like I was just so focused on doing the things that I wanted to be doing and then realized like later that, oh, I haven't really been spending any time with friends and things.
I think very often people get hung up on, you know, sacrifices, and I just don't buy it. I don't buy it. I mean, we make choices. And kind of a sacrifice makes it sound as though someone's making you do something, which I don't think is right.
Yeah. One thing I found is that, like, as you get older, you're a bit better at, like, life planning, and then you've had more experiences. So by, like, 30... Let's say you hit your Olympics at the peak between 30 and 40 as humans. Do you think a lot more people would have like the potential to kind of go and do that? But because of it's at like 20 to 30, that like there's loads of people never actually realize that they would have the option because they're sort of a bit like lost in like getting drunk and things.
That's kind of quite a good question because I think that if you're a female gymnast, your peak is 16, 20 or something. If you're a female swimmer, it's kind of similar. I think I was lucky in that as a rower, I didn't have to take it seriously until I was 16. There are rowers who start at 20 and become Olympic champions, where you're a whole lot more mature than you are as a teenager. And I think probably the younger you have to go through everything, probably the harder it is. Maybe you get more parental support. And I think there are lots of people who have got a whole lot of natural physical ability, but at whatever age, they don't want it. They're not hungry. And that's a critical part.
Yeah, and I guess also like maybe kind of growth mindset, as in I guess I've got like super more into it. I've always had it, but never quite like realized quite how much you can kind of do anything. So if I put myself through some tests and sort of worked out what my like natural physical ability was, and I actually had 10 years to sort of put into it, like I feel like we'd be able to like focus and sort of become like a champion or something. But I'm 30, so it doesn't matter. So it's not really a chance anymore. But it took me like sort of almost 30 years to sort of work out that if you put focus into something, you'll get there. But do you think like at 20, you just maybe haven't realized that or?
So I think at 20, I was willing to work hard. I was very, very happy to train my ass off. And being down at the training center at Leander Club in Henley was a great environment where it was easy to work hard. And I thought then that working hard was the answer. If I worked hard enough, it would be all right. Rather than if I learned fast. And the change that happened in the last 2 years of my rowing career was the learning bit, where we were just ruthless about making sure we were learning from every session rather than just working hard. And I wish I had started learning earlier in my rowing career because I think I probably could have done better.
Nice.
So the maturity about learning rather than just working hard, when that comes, if that comes to people.
Yeah, because there's like, the 10,000 hour rule isn't quite a 10,000 hour rule. It's definitely like 10,000 hour of like deliberate practice rule where you just always think about what's the hardest thing you can be doing and learning the most from.
And Anders, Anders Ericsson in his book, he doesn't say it's just 10,000 hours. It's a purposeful practice. And I think so often if we work hard at what we're doing in whatever job we're doing, we'll get better, which isn't necessarily the case. We just reinforce the habits we've got. And actually purposefully thinking this week, what am I going to improve? And reviewing it and going.
So as a rower, then what were the things that you are missing by just regularly rowing compared to when you then change your mindset to try and learn? What were like the things that you picked up on?
The first 7 years, we basically, we did exactly what the coach told us to do. And the coach, a guy called Jürgen Grobler, who was coach Cruz to win Olympic gold medals in 72, 76, 80, 88, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016. He's quite good. And his program clearly worked. I mean, it's incredible. Jürgen ran an incredibly successful program. It just didn't work for us. We weren't good enough physically to get it to work for us. So when we moved training center to set up our own base, probably 75-80% of the training that we did was Jürgen's program, maybe more. But we approached it pretty differently. Before every session, we'd get together and go, specifically, what are we trying to achieve this session? And in order to achieve that, what are the changes we need to make? And so when we talk about rhythm, let's be really, really clear. Specifically, what do we mean and which bit of it we're trying to change? And we'd have proper, detailed conversations, getting granular about the ingredients that go into whatever it was we were working on, so we could then have a chance to improve. Rather than beforehand going, right, it's 20K, we'll do 20 kilometers, 18 strokes a minute, heart rate this, off you go. That's just a physical session. It's got nothing to do with improving rowing technique. What we needed to do was, well, because physically we weren't that good, we needed to be physically as good as we could be, but technically we wanted to be the best crew in the world. And we wanted to be the most resilient crew, and we wanted to be the best team.
So did it take losing a few times to work out that you just physically were never going to be able to be the best?
It took me losing a lot of times. I lost a lot, and it took a bit of time to work out that actually just training harder wasn't going to work out. Generally, we learn stuff when we're ready to learn it. And would I have been open-minded to learn it 2 years earlier, 4 years earlier? I don't know. Maybe the opportunity wasn't there. Maybe people weren't talking to me about it. Maybe it was all right there in front of me, but I chose just to work harder.
Yeah, I read Frank Dick's book when I was like 14, 15, and was just like, wow, this is just all like sort of stupid quotes that like make sense and like are so easy. Like I do all of these things. And then like I read it again, like last year, I was like, holy shit, I've made all of these mistakes in my life. And like sort of like actually went in that time and like, crap, I'll actually do this properly kind of thing.
All the stuff about growth mindset, about continuous improvement, about the theory behind it is all really, really simple common sense. But common sense isn't common practice, and it's actually really hard to do. Reviewing every single thing, every single session you do, meeting you come out of, what worked, what didn't, what am I going to do better tomorrow? It's actually quite hard to do. So I think the first thing to do is always to go, okay, so what worked? Mm-hmm. What was I really good at? What did I do really well? Because firstly, you need to know what you're good at so you can repeat it. If always you're coming out going, oh, what didn't work so well, then you're not kind of shining a light on the stuff that you need to keep repeating. You're just looking at the stuff that's not so good. So for us, it was really important to start with what was good, what worked well, what did I do well, what did we do well, whatever the question is, to highlight actually what you are good at to make sure you can keep repeating it. And also, it then builds belief because you've got this whole load of stuff that actually we are really good at, and then you're going to pick holes in the stuff you're not so good at. And what do we do differently next time? That might be, okay, so let's actually just continue to develop the strengths, or it might be let's work on the weaknesses, or you know, who knows? You know, it gives you a whole lot of choices.
Yeah, you can get a bit obsessed in life of just like fixing your weaknesses when actually you get a lot more gains from like working
really
on your strengths.
At your strengths. You know, I think being aware of both is really important. And presumably with most of us in our roles of whatever we do, whether it be in sport or work, presumably we do most of it pretty well, because if not, we wouldn't be doing it. So if we were just to focus on getting better at the things we're good at, it would make a reasonable impact. I think you've also got to be aware of the bits you're rubbish at. So you should have a choice of, you know, which end of the spectrum do you work on?
I guess you work out like what's
needed at the time, what the balance is. Yeah.
What's holding you back. That's very, very logical and yes, not the most common practice. With all, will it make the boat go faster? which is what led to the title of your book.
Yeah, we were just, the whole time we were asking ourselves in the crew, you know, what are you going to do? Is it going to make the boat go faster? Doing this, will it make the boat go faster? Doing that? Because we couldn't control winning. All we could do was control boat speed. So therefore, boat speed was the most important thing. So therefore, we had to do stuff that would make the boat go faster.
Yeah, these things sort of seem to work with anything, like whether you're just doing like learning an instrument, business, relationships and stuff.
The thinking should apply.
So do you find it, have you ever applied it to your relationships and things, or does it come across a bit calculated when you're like, oh, this date didn't go so well, like, let's assess what worked. Okay, well, what didn't work?
So the doing it in a formal way with my wife doesn't work, but the number of evenings we've had where we go, oh, you know what I said to my son or my daughters, whatever, that didn't work. I've got to try and approach that situation differently. Or, you know, coming, you know, getting to the evening going, what a great day we had. What, you know, how do we manage to make it work so well? How do we manage to advise my daughter actually so she listened? You know, how do we do that again? Because it's quite hard to do. I don't necessarily do it in such a formalized way at home, but I absolutely do it. Because there are conversations we have that work and there are conversations we don't. And when they don't, I want to try and do it better next time. I want to, you know, if we've had a great evening as a family sitting around the dinner table, then, you know, I want to try and make sure
you can recreate it.
We recreate it, yeah.
It seems a bit wrong to be like analytical about things, but it's actually really good.
But why not?
Relationships.
Why wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Because if, you know, there are certain things I know that will piss my daughters off and close them down.
Yeah.
And if I'm not aware of what those things are, then I'll continue to piss them off and close them down and have a shit relationship. Whereas if I actually want to, you know, be a good husband and a good father, why wouldn't I want to try and learn from my mistakes and learn from what, you know, the few little bits that I do reasonably well? I think it kind of should apply to
life everywhere. Yeah. Cool. I've definitely enjoyed this sort of discussion area. You then eventually managed to win the gold having done this. How did that feel?
Quite good.
Did you feel like you completely deserved it?
So, did we deserve it? It's an interesting question. So, it depends what you mean by deserve. So, we had trained as hard or harder than anyone else. We had put in the hours the same as anyone else. Why should somebody else deserve it over us? Sitting there from a space of going, we deserve it, you know, I've done nothing and I deserve to win, is utter rubbish. But sitting on the start line, everybody was sitting there up for it. We had five crews alongside, one on one side and four on the other side. You know, everybody, you know, we'd done as much or more, who knows, as anyone. Why didn't we deserve it? And it was incredible. I was in the national team 9 years, and the very first race I won was 15 weeks before the Olympic final, which means I lost everything else I did.
Wow.
And to finally get it right. And the last 2 years were different. The last 2 years, we actually came second in everything we did. The year of the Sydney Olympics, we came second in the first race, and we won the next three. You know, losing heats and stuff along the way, but we won the races, the finals that counted. So that's a lie. There's what, Henley Royal Regatta, 13 weeks, 12 weeks before, can't remember how long, we lost there. But we won, you know, we won the two big regattas leading up to the Olympics. So sitting there, yeah, we were confident. Yeah, we were up for it. Yeah, we had deserved it as much as anyone else. The World Championships here before we came second. We rode a pretty good race. We had a plan of how to beat the Americans. And as it was at the end, where we thought we'd change gear and piss off and beat them, they changed gear and pissed off and beat us. And they were just better than us. The year of the Sydney Olympics, the first regatta, we messed up in the final and we came second behind the Croatians, and that was kind of fair enough. Vienna, we rode actually not that well, but we beat everybody. Lucerne, we, with a reserve on board, we rode pretty damn well and we beat everybody. In the heat of the Olympics, we lost to the Aussies. We rode really badly and we lost to them. I think they would say if you rode the race 100 times, they would win it 80% of the time or something. Yeah. And we would say the same thing. They'd beaten us twice that year. We beat them twice that year. And then it was all on the line in the Olympic final. We knew that when we rode well, we were really, really fast. And on that day, we rode really, really well. And we laid down every single drop of passion, aggression, and energy with the technique that we'd worked so hard on. and we put together For Us a Perfect Race.
Nice. Well, obviously, congratulations.
It was a good day at the office.
But what do you think would have happened in the rest of your life if you hadn't won? Because you technically still have all the same lessons from, like, will it make the boat go faster and stuff, but you think you'd have been able to, like, write that book and sort of start this?
No.
Yeah.
So I came away from the Olympics, being in the national team for 9 years and having won the Olympics. And I then started trying to work out what the hell to do next. And I thought, maybe some sort of corporate training. I didn't really know what it was, but maybe that would be interesting. And I called all sorts of people. And when I said, I've come back from the Olympics and I won, everyone was happy to talk to me. I eventually found somebody who was happy to talk to me and then actually give me a job. But if I had have come back and said, oh, well, I came seventh again, not many people would have spoken to me. And, you know, I do a lot of speeches these days. And for me to stand up and tell a great story about how we came seventh, not many people would want to listen to. People want to hear from somebody who's won rather than a loser. And also, if I had have lost again, I wonder whether I'd be quite bitter. Having put 9, 10, 11, depending on how you count it, is my life into it. If I had have just lost everything, I think I might be quite bitter about stuff.
It's a bit of a danger because if you want to be really inspiring to maybe kids and make them sort of follow their dreams into the Olympics, but also you could waste 10 years of someone's life if they only ever come fourth and fifth or something and they never really have anything to write home about and they just focus on stuff and maybe they could have had a great career doing something else that they've missed out on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a massive risk.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to put yourself out there to have a go and who knows how well you do it. And also it depends on expectations. If you come back from the Olympics having come 27th in the marathon, got a personal best, you should be delighted. Our expectations were that we could be fast enough to win. And therefore that became all consuming and the result was about winning. For some people, you know, really high expectations are about competing and coming home with a kit. And that's fine. We all compete at our different levels, but there's a massive risk involved to all this stuff. If you want to achieve whatever your dream is, then you've got to put yourself out there. And yeah, I don't know how balanced I would be if I had of just put my heart and soul into everything and lost everything I ever did. I may not be that balanced or happy. So thank God I did.
Yeah, definitely.
Calling all humans who want to increase their skills. It's time to explore and deepen existing passions and get lost in creativity with Skillshare's online classes. What you find might just surprise and inspire you. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers memberships with a meaning. There's so much to explore and real projects to create, and the support of other fellow creators going on, Skillshare really empowers you just to accomplish growth and success in what you want to do. It's also incredibly affordable, especially when compared to pricey in-person classes and workshops. An annual subscription is less than £10 a month. I've really enjoyed the YouTube success tutorials, and also their productivity ones are just super useful for making you a more productive human. They're a great company, and they are very proud to be sponsoring the Growth Mindset podcast. So you can explore your creativity at skillshare.com/growth mindset and get 2 free months of premium membership. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of different classes for free. Whether you want to learn to code or handstand, everything's there. Get started and join today by heading to skillshare.com/growth mindset. Again, that is skillshare.com/growth mindset.
Okay, at what point of stage in your life were you then? Had you met your wife? Had you already started having children?
We got engaged 15, 18 months before the Olympics and we planned to get married 3 weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
So I had quite a big month.
I can't remember looking at me that sounds like a really nice year.
Yeah, it was. So came back from the Olympics, had a week. So my wife's half Italian, so we got married in Italy, came back from the Olympics, had a week in England. I went out to Italy. Is that right? I think a week in England. And then I think I went out to Italy for a week and then got married. So 3 weeks after the final, I think that's right. Yeah. So a week in Australia after racing for the rest of the Olympics, a week in England, going out, having fun, seeing friends, family, getting pissed. Mm. Then a week in Italy, vaguely trying to help preparations, although my mother-in-law had done it all. Then we got married. Then we went backpacking for 3 months, I think. Backpacking around India, Nepal, Tibet. Came back. My wife was pregnant. I had no job. We were living with my dad. And it was time to kind of grow up and get on with life.
Yes, and it's funny because you think someone that wins a gold medal is probably knowing what they're doing with their life. But
I had no plan past my wedding day. I thought that I'd stop competing after Sydney. And as soon as I crossed the line, I knew that was it. But what came next? I had no idea. And at that point, I was 28. I'd never had a job. I had no qualifications. I dropped out of two university courses. If I had have lost, then I really did would have nothing going for me. Having won, I had something going for me and to kind of get on with it. And I came back and worked pretty hard and getting a job, and it took 5 months to find a job, and then I got on with the next thing.
It's really important, like, if you want to do something sort of like public speaking and stuff, they say you should always have a story to tell. That's obviously winning an Olympic medal is a pretty good story. But do you think you maybe could have worked out a different story if you had one of these coaching?
So I didn't want to tell a story. I didn't want to do speeches. I joined a training company called SI Group, and they had, we call ourselves performance coaches. I mean, we were kind of, we ran these training courses, these mindset behavior change training courses. And then there were a few people who did speeches who weren't sports people. They just did speeches about mindset, and they were really good at that. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a, what we call ourselves, coach. So, which was effectively running training sessions. And I worked for them for 2.5 years. And there were some groups I spent probably 8 days with those spread over a number of months. And by the time I'd finished these 6 or 8 days with them, they would think that I was an enthusiastic rower, but they wouldn't know anything about the fact that I'd been to the Olympics or not, because I just didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to be good at the job for being good at the job rather than what I'd done before. Yeah. All the other coaches I worked with, there were 15 or so in the company. None of them were sports people. They all had come from different business backgrounds, and they were just really, really credible and good because they were good. And I wanted to be credible and good at doing my job because I was credible and good, not because I had history behind me.
Makes sense to like not take the easy option to kind of build like your whole base to then sort of be able to work on that and grow it. So back to like your original like what worked, what didn't work kind of thing. It sort of, it would have worked if you'd said like, I'm an Olympian, but then you'd never have got that far because you'd always been too weak in the other aspects. You wouldn't be able to like deliver on everything.
We had these, see, these training courses. Knowing the content was obviously really important. Being able to kind of challenge and coach and facilitate was important. Being able to entertain and engage people was really important. The kind of presentation style. There were loads of bits that I just wanted to be. It was a great environment for me, actually, because I was, you know, I'm quite competitive, and I went into this place and there were, say, 15 or so other coaches, and they were all really good, and I was rubbish. It was very clear I knew nothing. And my competitive instinct came out, but rather than trying to beat people, it was about, and you know, you can't compete against people in terms of running courses, but I wanted some self-respect to going, you know, I want to be as good as these people.
Cool. So what you're like biggest lessons then as a coach and how to like facilitate things or how to coach people and deal with like the things that asking difficult questions kind of get the most out of someone. Like how did you learn that skill?
Slowly, I think. I mean, I read or listen to quite a lot of stuff. I've been on a few courses. I've learned a lot from watching other facilitators. I think that being willing to ask the difficult question is really important. And there have been some situations where I have asked a question being quite sure that it would lead to me not being engaged with that client again. But I think you've got to be honest and you've got to say what you think and you've got to ask the right questions. I think straightforwardness and honesty are pretty important. And yeah, a job of a coach, of a facilitator is to make people aware of what's happening, either what they're doing or all the other stuff that's going on around them. And sometimes that means people learn stuff they didn't think they wanted to hear. But if you've got more information, you can make better decisions. So having an ability to ask good questions and the courage to ask them sometimes, I think is quite important.
I've certainly learned a lot about that, like doing the podcast. And it's been quite useful. Sometimes I get people that I maybe don't want to interview that much, but because I'm not so bothered, I'll be a bit more ballsy to just ask them difficult questions. And it ends up making it like a really good interview, even though I wasn't expecting anything. Whereas if it's someone like I know really well and is famous, I'm a bit like, it's a bit harder to be like really cool about it. Okay. So where do you see the field of coaching in general going? And like in 5 years time, do you think there's going to be a bit of a shift in the way people do it and like what businesses are focusing on to get the most?
So I think 20 years ago, no one was coached in a business environment. 15 years ago, it started to grow. 10 years ago, it was going absolutely berserk. I think that now, if companies are paying for coaching, they want it to be far, far more business focused. And they've got to be very, very clear business outcomes. I think businesses have been through phases of trying to teach staff internally to coach individuals better. And I'm not sure how successful that's been. I think being as a manager or a leader, having a certain coaching capability is good. I think there's a huge move to learning being more computer-based. There are also things you can learn digitally. And when it comes to people skills, there's got to be human interaction. Yeah. So I think coaching and kind of learning and development, I think more of it will become digital, but there is still a massive need for human interaction. But it's got to be more closely tied into businesses, and they've got to know they're getting good return on investment.
Are you guys working to deliver more digital stuff and to deliver more like specific outcomes from your face-to-face work?
So digital, we're going to look at in the second half of 2020. We've looked at it a couple of times, and we're going to have another look. And we are really outcome-led, and we will continue to be so, and we will work to measure it even more effectively. I think that teaching somebody some leadership skills is totally pointless unless they have the opportunity to actually do something with it. I think people are so busy at the moment. Skills for the sake of it, no one uses. So actually, it's got to be tied into your specific situation. So the application bit of learning is, I think, is critical.
Yeah, definitely.
Knowledge for the sake of it is lovely.
Definitely. People ask you, like, what's the best book to read? And you're like, well, then what are you doing right now? Because if you read the right book at the right time, it's like insane. If you read like a book just for knowledge and it's not appropriate, it's just pointless.
You don't do anything with it. And knowledge for the sake of it, in some situations, might be useful, but in terms of a corporate development thing, knowledge has got to be specific. It's got to be totally applicable. So we spend huge amounts of time with people working on how are you going to apply it? That's kind of the understand, practice, apply bit. And if you want to learn about bullshit filters or bounce back ability, I can teach you all areas you need to know in 5 minutes, but that doesn't mean you can do bullshit filters. It doesn't mean you can do resilience. It means you might have some knowledge about it. And actually, the only thing that matters is being able to do it. So all our theory is really simple theory to try and give people the maximum opportunity to apply it.
Can you explain what they are quickly? Or
bullshit filters. So focus is really important, but there are so many things that distract us. People telling us, oh, we can do, you shouldn't do this, you should do that. Yeah. There are so many different distractions. And when I was rowing, we came up with this thing about bullshit filters, about kind of these imaginary ear defenders. You can whack them up to maximum deflection and the bullshit just wouldn't get through. So when people were telling us that we couldn't do it, that we weren't good enough at that, we weren't strong enough, we couldn't do this, it was bullshit. It just wouldn't get through. We wouldn't listen. Effectively, we'd be going, la, 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 I'm not listening to you. Because it wasn't, if the goal was about boat speed, people telling us we couldn't do it wasn't going to help us achieve that. Therefore, we didn't want to listen to them.
So as in like having a really good mission statement would be a bullshit filter if you always go back to your mission statement going, hey, is this going to make the company get to this? And if you're like, oh, no, then it's a distraction.
Then it's a distraction. Therefore, I'm not going to engage with it. I'm not going to listen to you telling me that I can't do it. If you're going, you know, I think you need to work on this or this or this, or you've got these weaknesses. Now, that's helpful information that'll help me achieve it. But if you're just telling me I'm rubbish, that's just not helpful. So that's bullshit filters. Stuff invariably will go wrong at various times. How do you make sure you get back on it as soon as you possibly can and start performing? Because if you're deflated, demotivated, pissed off, frustrated, feeling lethargic and flat, you're not going to be performing very well. So your results aren't going to be very good and you're unlikely to achieve your goal. So when stuff goes wrong, how do you learn from it, pick yourself up, dust yourself off so that you can get back on to performing well to give you a chance of getting a result? And depending on how bad the setback is, will probably take time, different amounts of time to recover from it so you can be firing on all cylinders again.
Is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you about?
I don't think so, no.
And then on the subject, actually, when I was asking you what's the most difficult thing to ask you, what do you think might be the most difficult thing to ask me if you were coaching me?
I have no idea, Sam. I'm afraid I just don't know enough about you. I don't know what you're trying to achieve. Having had a 5-minute conversation beforehand, I'm afraid I'm not a good enough coach to be able to know exactly what the right question is because I just don't know you well enough.
Okay. How do you think I could have improved this interview?
So I've done a few podcasts before. This is an observation rather than this is what you should do because I don't know the answer. A lot of people come with a more structured approach, whereas you've come with a pretty open approach. You've made loads and loads of notes as we've gone through, which you've kind of referred to, and that's kind of led to the next question going on. So the people I've done podcasts with before haven't made notes in the way you have done. So I'd say that's kind of a really good thing. The, you know, possibly knowing more to, if you know more to start with, then does that shape it? And it means you don't.
That's my issues. And I find sometimes with my guests, especially when it's someone who is kind of famous, I'm less likely to ask difficult questions if I know them really well, kind of things. And I'm not sure if I sort of read your book and I was like, wow, I'm going to meet Ben. This is amazing. I might have been a bit scared to like be me. Whereas if I'm just like, I meet this guy, I don't really know who he is.
Maybe on the other hand, if you had of read something, then maybe you would know which different questions. So then the bit about being worried about asking the difficult questions, I would say that, you know, maybe that's something you should think about. Because why should you possibly be worried? I don't know what the worst that can happen, but probably not that bad. You know, people approach things in different ways. So, and I don't know what works for you. I guess I'd say, you know, preparation. Is that something that would help? I don't know. That's for you to figure out. It's a bit about kind of asking difficult questions about what, what's to stop you asking difficult questions. Because the person at the other end can always just say, no, I'm not going to, or answer something completely different. But unless you actually have the courage to ask it, you'll never, you haven't got a chance to get into the answer.
I guess like trying to find the right balance is interesting, and like at what kind of point in the interview you're in and stuff. It's like, I'm not sure what's really appropriate and like a difficult question. Cause I could ask you like what your favorite sex position is.
So just to explain why I said such an out of place thing. Sometimes I have this issue where my brain comes up with like a bad idea that it shouldn't do. And normally I just ignore the bad idea. But then sometimes it's such a bad idea that the rest of my brain, it starts panicking that I might do it, and it will like be screaming at me like, you mustn't say this, Sam, just don't do it, never say this thing. But the problem is then that I kind of run out of brain space. I like, I've got this one option of something to say, and the rest of my brain is occupied just telling me to not say it. And it's just like I go into like this blue screen of death, and I can't really think of anything until I say the stupid thing that I thought of, so that I can actually get my brain back. So you shouldn't really say things like that if you can avoid it. But I can confirm that if it does sound awkward in the interview for the next minute or so, that's because it is. I was totally out of line saying something like that, and we both didn't really know where to look. I basically wanted the ground to eat me. Somehow, I did manage to get the interview back on track, but trust me, I was rather beating myself up the whole time, and you shouldn't ask a member of the Order of Excellent British Empire about their favourite sex position, obviously. Anyway, enjoy the rest of the interview. And my heartfelt apologies to Ben.
But like, I don't know how I can ask you like a difficult question as such, as in maybe, I feel like going into what you'd have done with if you hadn't have won was kind of interesting. Don't know if that was difficult at all as such. What do you think was the biggest thing you've got wrong in life?
I've treated a few people really badly. I think I've been a bit of a bastard to a couple of people and I really regret that.
Do you think there's anything you can do to like, fix that now?
Well, I haven't had the courage to anyway. Let's put it like that.
If I said like your number one goal for the next 2 weeks is to fix that, what do you think you would do?
I'd have to figure out how to get hold of them. I guess instead I feel bad about some relationships I've had and just don't do anything about it.
Do you think there's lessons you've taken away from that which have helped you now that you changed the way you are?
Yeah, I think so.
Can you give an example of like how you show up in life now because of this?
I try very hard to treat people well. I try very hard to. And as a business owner, when we have to make difficult decisions about people, we try very hard to do the right thing and to treat people really well. In fact, at any point, we work really hard to treat the people who work with us decently, properly, fairly, openly. I think it's really important.
Yeah, you seem like you've came across like that. I was a bit surprised when you said that you treated people badly. It was not of all the things that I thought you said you'd have made if got wrong.
Well, that's what I regret most, because I think it's really important. So that's why I regret what I regret most.
That makes a lot of sense. Really quickly, what's your probably earliest memory ever from childhood?
Earliest memory from childhood is a house I lived in Hong Kong. I've got some memories from a kind of first time I went to Hong Kong, where I must have been 3 or 4 or something. I've got kind of vague bits of memory about a swimming pool, about the house I was in, the kind of the vague bits of memory.
What's the kindest thing someone has ever done for you?
We had a team of volunteers around us who all gave up huge amounts of time and energy to help. I mean, there have been people have been incredibly kind. Before the Olympics, we needed to 3 months, 4 months before we needed to raise some money to buy a new boat. Wrote to a whole load of complete strangers who a number coughed up a whole load of money. And since then, I've had people I've asked for help and they've given it, or people who have just said, you know, can I do this for you? or, you know, who give time and energy. So I think loads of people have been incredibly kind.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. That's a pleasure.
Really good having you on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Awesome.
So, what a great interview, despite myself being useless. But anyway, thanks so much to Ben for making the time and Google for the podcast studio. I learned so much from Ben and just love his honesty and the fact that he's really in touch with the real truth behind his actions instead of putting a positive spin on things. I think I'll always remember him telling me about the fact that actually he was driven by a selfish urge and that claiming that he was making a big sacrifice would be lying. Then the fact that he just risked so much is crazy. You know, possibly ending his Olympic career without a win and turning 30 with no degree or work experience is a really big risk. And so these athletes are mental people when you think about it. I think Ben, realizing that his team were simply never going to be good enough physically, took some real humility for them all to then just focus on how they could do everything that they could to make the boat go faster. I think it just shows a really good growth mindset to find yourself with a limitation or a barrier, but to seek a way to push through it when others might just give up or just accept defeat with something that, you know, you think you can't change. And I think that we all have circumstances where we accept things as they are, but if we were to break it down and think about it, we could find ways to improve our situation. I would really recommend reading his book, Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? And learning more about his story and concepts like creating bullshit filters and improving your bounce back ability are super useful, and just improving your growth mindset, of course. So in summary, great to have him on the show. Next week, we have an episode with Rosie Holloway, who is an amazing up-and-coming musician with a voice that just kind of gives you tingles. She's super good, and she has a crazy story of abuse and addictions and dealing with just a huge amount of crap that life throws at you to get to where she is now. So stay tuned for next week, and if you're not a subscriber, become one. And on that note, have a great week. Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me @samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.